immediate and transitory, but it must show a spirit of uncompromising perseverance in carrying through a long struggle which will secure for it a long period of inner growth. All those movements which owe their expansion to a so-called combination of similar organisms, which means that their external strength is due to a policy of compromise, are like plants whose growth is forced in a hothouse. They shoot up externally, but they lack that inner strength which enables the natural plant to grow into a tree that will withstand the storms of centuries. The greatness of every powerful organization which embodies a creative idea lies in the spirit of religious devotion and intolerance with which it stands out against all others, because it has an ardent faith in its own right. If an idea is right in itself, and, furnished with the fighting weapons I have mentioned, wages war on this earth, then it is invincible, and persecution will only add to its internal strength. The greatness of Christianity did not arise from attempts to make compromises with those philosophical opinions of the ancient world, which had some resemblance to its own doctrine, but in the unrelenting and fanatical proclamation and defence of its own teaching. The apparent advance that a movement makes by associating itself with other movements will be easily reached and surpassed by the steady increase of strength which a doctrine and its organisation acquires if it remains independent and fights its own cause alone. XIII. The movement ought to educate its adherents to the principle that struggle must not be considered a necessary evil, but as something to be desired in itself. Therefore, they must not be afraid of the hostility which their adversaries manifest towards them, but they must take it as a necessary condition on which their whole right to existence is based. They must not try to avoid being hated by those who are the enemies of our people and our philosophy of life, but must welcome such hatred. Lies and calumnies are part of the method which the enemy employs to express his chagrin. The man who is not opposed and vilified and slandered in the Jewish press is not a staunch German, and not a true National Socialist. The best rule whereby the sincerity of his convictions, his character, and strength of will can be measured is the hostility which his name arouses among the mortal enemies of our people. The followers of the movement, and indeed the whole nation, must be reminded again and again of the fact that through the medium of his newspapers, the Jew is always spreading falsehood, and that if he tells the truth on some occasions, it is only for the purpose of masking some greater deceit, which turns the apparent truth into a deliberate falsehood. The Jew is the great master of lies. Falsehood and duplicity are the weapons with which he fights. Every calumny and falsehood published by the Jews are tokens of honour which can be worn by our comrades. He whom they decry most is nearest to our hearts, and he whom they mortally hate is our best friend. If a comrade of ours opens a Jewish newspaper in the morning and does not find himself vilified there, then he has spent yesterday to no account. for if he had achieved something, he would be persecuted, slandered, derided, and abused. Those who effectively combat this mortal enemy of our people, who is at the same time the enemy of all Aryan peoples and all culture, can only expect to arouse opposition on the part of this race and become the object of its slanderous attacks. When these truths become part of the flesh and blood, as it were, of our members, then the movement will be impregnable and invincible. 14. The movement must use all possible means to cultivate respect for the individual personality. It must never forget that all human values are based on personal values, and that every idea and achievement is the fruit of the creative power of one man. We must never forget that admiration for everything that is great is not only a tribute to one creative personality, but that all those who feel such admiration become thereby united under one covenant. Nothing can take the place of the individual, especially if the individual embodies in himself not the mechanical element, but the element of cultural creativeness. No pupil can take the place of the master in completing a great picture which he has left unfinished. And just in the same way, no substitute can take the place of the great poet or thinker, or the great statesman or military general. For the source of their power is in the realm of artistic creativeness. It can never be mechanically acquired, because it is an innate product of divine grace. The greatest revolutions and the greatest achievements of this world, its greatest cultural works and the immortal creations of great statesmen, are inseparably bound up with one name which stands as a symbol for them in each respective case. The failure to pay tribute to one of those great spirits signifies a neglect of that enormous source of power which lies in the remembrance of all great men and women. The Jew himself knows this best. He, whose great men have always been great only in their efforts to destroy mankind and its civilization, takes good care that they are worshipped as idols. But the Jew tries to degrade the honour in which nations hold their great men and women. He stigmatizes this honour as the cult of personality. As soon as a nation has so far lost its courage as to submit to this impudent defamation on the part of the Jews, it renounces the most important source of its own inner strength. This inner force cannot arise from a policy of pandering to the masses, but only from the worship of men of genius, whose lives have uplifted and ennobled the nation itself. When men's hearts are breaking and their souls are plunged into the depths of despair, their great forebears turn their eyes towards them from the dim shadows of the past, those forebears who knew how to triumph over anxiety and affliction, mental servitude and physical bondage, and extend their eternal hands in a gesture of encouragement to despairing souls. Woe to the nation that is ashamed to clasp those hands. During the initial phase of our movement, our greatest handicap was the fact that none of us were known, and our names meant nothing, a fact which then seemed to some of us to make the chances of final success problematical. Our most difficult task, then, was to make our members firmly believe that there was a tremendous future in store for the movement, and to maintain this belief as a living faith. For at that time, only 6, 7, or 8 persons came to hear one of our speakers. Consider that only 6 or 7 poor devils, who were entirely unknown, came together to found a movement which should succeed in doing what the great mass parties had failed to do, namely, to reconstruct the German Reich, even in greater power and glory than before. We should have been very pleased if we were attacked or even ridiculed. But the most depressing fact was that nobody paid any attention to us whatever. This utter lack of interest in us caused me great mental pain at that time. When I entered the circle of those men, there was not yet any question of a party or a movement. I have already described the impression which was made on me when I first came into contact with that small organization. Subsequently, I had time and also the occasion to study the form of this so-called party, which had at first made such a woeful impression. The picture was indeed quite depressing and discouraging. There was nothing, absolutely nothing at all. There was only the name of a party, and the committee consisted of all the party members. Somehow or other, it seemed just the kind of thing we were about to fight against, a miniature parliament. The voting system was employed. When the great parliament cried until they were hoarse, at least they shouted over problems of importance, here this small circle engaged in interminable discussions as to the form in which they might answer the letters which they were delighted to have received. Needless to say, the public knew nothing of all this. In Munich, nobody knew of the existence of such a party, not even by name, except our few members and their small circle of acquaintances. Every Wednesday, what was called a committee meeting was held in one of the cafes, and a debate was arranged for one evening each week. In the beginning, all the members of the movement were also members of the committee. Therefore, the same persons always turned up at both meetings. The first step that had to be taken was to extend the narrow limits of this small circle and get new members. But the principal necessity was to utilize all the means at our command for the purpose of making the movement known. We chose the following methods. We decided to hold a monthly meeting, to which the public would be invited. Some of the invitations were typewritten, and some were written by hand. For the first few meetings, we distributed them in the streets and delivered them personally at certain houses. Each one canvassed among his own acquaintances and tried to persuade some of them to attend our meetings. The result was lamentable. I still remember how once I personally delivered 80 of these invitations, and how we waited in the evening for the crowds to come. After waiting in vain for a whole hour, the chairman finally had to open the meeting. Again, there were only 7 people present. The old, familiar 7. We then changed our methods. We had the invitations written with a typewriter in a Munich stationer's shop, and then multigraphed them. The result was that a few more people attended our next meeting. The number increased gradually from 11 to 13 to 17 to 23 and finally to 34. We collected some money within our own circle, each poor devil giving a small contribution, and in that way we raised sufficient funds to be able to advertise one of our meetings in the Munich Observer, which was still an independent paper. This time we had an astonishing success. We had chosen the Munich Hofbrauhausgeller, which must not be confounded with the Munich Hofbrauhaus Festsaal, as our meeting place. It was a small hall and would accommodate scarcely more than 130 people. To me, however, the hall seemed enormous, and we were all trembling lest this tremendous edifice would remain partly empty on the night of the meeting. At 7 o'clock, 111 persons were present, and the meeting was opened. A Munich professor delivered the principal address, and I spoke after him. That was my first appearance in the role of public orator. The whole thing seemed a very daring adventure to Herr Harrer, who was then chairman of the party. He was a very decent fellow, but he had an a priori conviction that, although I might have quite a number of good qualities, I certainly did not have a talent for public speaking. Even later, he could not be persuaded to change his opinion. But he was mistaken. 20 minutes had been allotted to me for my speech on this occasion, which might be looked on as our first public meeting. I talked for 30 minutes, and what I always had felt deep down in my heart, without being able to put it to the test, was here proved to be true. I could make a good speech. At the end of the 30 minutes, it was quite clear that all the people in the little hall had been profoundly impressed. The enthusiasm aroused among them found its first expression in the fact that my appeal to those present brought us donations which amounted to 300 marks. That was a great relief for us. Our finances were at that time so meagre that we could not afford to have our party prospectus printed, or even leaflets. Now we possessed at least the nucleus of a fund from which we could pay the most urgent and necessary expenses. But the success of this first larger meeting was also important from another point of view. I had already begun to introduce some young and fresh members into the committee. During the long period of my military service, I had come to know a large number of good comrades whom I was now able to persuade to join our party. All of them were energetic and disciplined young men who, through their years of military service, had been imbued with the principle that nothing is impossible, and that where there's a will, there's a way. The need for this fresh blood supply became evident to me after a few weeks of collaboration with the new members. Herr Harrer, who was then chairman of the party, was a journalist by profession, and as such he was a man of general knowledge. But as leader of the party, he had one very serious handicap. He could not speak to the crowd. Though he did his work conscientiously, it lacked the necessary driving force, probably for the reason that he had no oratorical gifts whatsoever. Herr Drechsler, at that time chairman of the Munich local group, was a simple working man. He, too, was not of any great importance as a speaker. Moreover, he was not a soldier. He had never done military service, even during the war. So that this man, who was feeble and diffident by nature, had missed the only school which knows how to transform diffident and weakly natures into real men. Therefore, neither of those two men were of the stuff that would have enabled them to stir up an ardent and indomitable faith in the ultimate triumph of the movement, and to brush aside with obstinate force, and if necessary with brutal ruthlessness, all obstacles that stood in the path of the new idea. Such a task could be carried out only by men who had been trained, body and soul, in those military virtues which make a man, so to speak, agile as a greyhound, tough as leather, and hard as Krupp steel. At that time, I was still a soldier. Physically and mentally, I had the polish of 6 years of service, so that in the beginning this circle must have looked on me as quite a stranger. In common with my army comrades, I had forgotten such phrases as, "That will not go," or "That is not possible," or "We ought not to take such a risk. It is too dangerous." The whole undertaking was, of its very nature, dangerous. At that time, there were many parts of Germany where it would have been absolutely impossible openly to invite people to a national meeting that dared to make a direct appeal to the masses. Those who attended such meetings were usually dispersed and driven away with broken heads. It certainly did not call for any great qualities to be able to do things in that way. The largest so-called bourgeois mass meetings were accustomed to dissolve, and those in attendance would run away like rabbits when frightened by a dog, as soon as a dozen communists appeared on the scene. The Reds used to pay little attention to those bourgeois organizations where only babblers talked. They recognized the inner triviality of such associations much better than the members themselves, and therefore felt that they need not be afraid of them. On the contrary, however, they were all the more determined to use every possible means of annihilating once and for all any movement that appeared to them to be a danger to their own interests. The most effective means which they always employed in such cases were terror and brute force. The Marxist leaders, whose business consisted in deceiving and misleading the public, naturally hated most of all a movement whose declared aim was to win over those masses which hitherto had been exclusively at the service of international Marxism in the Jewish and Stock Exchange parties. The title alone, German Labour Party, irritated them. It could be easily foreseen that at the first opportune moment we should have to face the opposition of the Marxist despots, who were still intoxicated with their triumph in 1918. People in the small circles of our own movement at that time showed a certain amount of anxiety at the prospect of such a conflict. They wanted to refrain as much as possible from coming out into the open, because they feared that they might be attacked and beaten. In their minds they saw our first public meetings broken up, and feared that the movement might thus be ruined for ever. I found it difficult to defend my own position, which was that the conflict should not be evaded, but that it should be faced openly, and that we should be armed with those weapons which are the only protection against brute force. Terror cannot be overcome by the weapons of the mind, but only by counter-terror. The success of our first public meeting strengthened my own position. The members felt encouraged to arrange for a second meeting, on an even larger scale. Sometime in October 1919, the second, larger meeting took place in the Erbel Braukeller. The theme of our speeches was Brest-Litovsk and Versailles. There were 4 speakers. I talked for almost an hour, and the success was even more striking than at our first meeting. The number of people who attended had grown to more than 130. An attempt to disturb the proceedings was immediately frustrated by my comrades. The would-be disturbers were thrown down the stairs, bearing imprints of violence on their heads. A fortnight later, another meeting took place in the same hall. The number in attendance had now increased to more than 170, which meant that the room was fairly well filled. I spoke again, and once more the success obtained was greater than at the previous meeting. Then I proposed that a larger hall should be found. After looking around for some time, we discovered one at the other end of the town, in the Deutschen Reich, in the Dachauer Straße. The first meeting at this new rendezvous had a smaller attendance than the previous meeting. There were just less than 140 present. The members of the committee began to be discouraged, and those who had always been sceptical were now convinced that this falling off in the attendance was due to the fact that we were holding the meetings at too short intervals. There were lively discussions, in which I upheld my own opinion that a city with 700,000 inhabitants ought to be able not only to stand one meeting every fortnight, but 10 meetings every week. I held that we should not be discouraged by one comparative setback, that the tactics we had chosen were correct, and that sooner or later success would be ours if we only continued with determined perseverance to push forward on our road. The whole winter of 1919 to 1920 was one continual struggle to strengthen confidence in our ability to carry the movement through to success, and to intensify this confidence until it became a burning faith that could move mountains. Our next meeting in the small hall proved the truth of my contention. Our audience had increased to more than 200. The publicity effect and the financial success were splendid. I immediately urged that a further meeting should be held. It took place in less than a fortnight, and there were more than 270 people present. 2 weeks later, we invited our followers and their friends for the seventh time to attend our meeting. The same hall was scarcely large enough for the number that came. They amounted to more than 400. During this phase, the young movement developed its inner form. Sometimes we had more or less hefty discussions within our small circle. From various sides, it was then just the same as it is today, objections were made against the idea of calling the young movement a party. I have always considered such criticism as a demonstration of practical incapability and narrow-mindedness on the part of the critic. Those objections have always been raised by men who could not differentiate between external appearances and inner strength, but tried to judge the movement by the high-sounding character of the name attached to it. To this end, they ransacked the vocabulary of our ancestors with unfortunate results. At that time, it was very difficult to make the people understand that every movement is a party as long as it has not brought its ideals to final triumph and thus achieved its purpose. It is a party even if it give itself 1,000 different names. Any person who tries to carry into practice an original idea whose realization would be for the benefit of his fellow men will first have to look for disciples who are ready to fight for the ends he has in view. And if these ends did not go beyond the destruction of the party system, and therewith put a stop to the process of disintegration, then all those who come forward as protagonists and apostles of such an ideal are a party in themselves, as long as their final goal is reached. It is only hair-splitting and playing with words when these antiquated theorists, whose practical success is in reverse ratio to their wisdom, presume to think they can change the character of a movement which is at the same time a party by merely changing its name. On the contrary, it is entirely out of harmony with the spirit of the nation to keep harping on that far-off and forgotten nomenclature which belongs to the ancient Germanic times and does not awaken any distinct association in our age. This habit of borrowing words from the dead past tends to mislead the people into thinking that the external trappings of its vocabulary are the important feature of a movement. It is really a mischievous habit, but it is quite prevalent nowadays. At that time, and subsequently, I had to warn followers repeatedly against these wandering scholars who were peddling Germanic folklore and who never accomplished anything positive or practical except to cultivate their own superabundant self-conceit. The new movement must guard itself against an influx of people whose only recommendation is their own statement that they've been fighting for these very same ideals during the last 30 or 40 years. Now, if somebody has fought for 40 years to carry into effect what he calls an idea, and if these alleged efforts not only show no positive results, but have not even been able to hinder the success of the opposing party, then the story of those 40 years of futile effort furnishes sufficient proof for the incompetence of such a protagonist. People of that kind are specially dangerous because they do not want to participate in the movement as ordinary members. They talk rather of the leading positions which would be the only fitting posts for them, in view of their past work, and also so that they might be enabled to carry on that work further. But woe to a young movement if the conduct of it should fall into the hands of such people. A businessman who has been in charge of a great firm for 40 years, and who has completely ruined it through his mismanagement, is not the kind of person one would recommend for the founding of a new firm. And it is just the same with a new national movement. Nobody of common sense would appoint to a leading post in such a movement some Teutonic Methuselah who had been ineffectively preaching some idea for a period of 40 years, until himself and his idea had entered the stage of senile decay. Furthermore, only a very small percentage of such people join a new movement with the intention of serving its end unselfishly and helping in the spread of its principles. In most cases, they come because they think that, under the aegis of the new movement, it will be possible for them to promulgate their old ideas to the misfortune of their new listeners. Anyhow, nobody ever seems able to describe what exactly these ideas are. It is typical of such persons that they rant about ancient Teutonic heroes of the dim and distant ages, stone axes, battle spears, and shields, whereas in reality they themselves are the woefulest poltroons imaginable. For those very same people who brandish Teutonic tin swords that have been fashioned carefully according to ancient models, and wear padded bearskins, with the horns of oxen mounted over their bearded faces, proclaim that all contemporary conflicts must be decided by the weapons of the mind alone. And thus they skedaddle when the first communist cudgel appears. Posterity will have little occasion to write a new epic on these heroic gladiators. I have seen too much of that kind of people not to feel a profound contempt for their miserable play-acting. To the masses of the nation, they are just an object of ridicule. But the Jew finds it to his own interest to treat these folklore comedians with respect, and to prefer them to real men who are fighting to establish a German state. And yet these comedians are extremely proud of themselves. Notwithstanding their complete fecklessness, which is an established fact, they pretend to know everything better than other people, so much so that they make themselves a veritable nuisance to all sincere and honest patriots, to whom not only the heroism of the past is worthy of honour, but who also feel bound to leave examples of their own work for the inspiration of the coming generation. Among those people there were some whose conduct can be explained by their innate stupidity and incompetence. But there are others who have a definite ulterior purpose in view. Often it is difficult to distinguish between the two classes. The impression which I often get, especially of those so-called religious reformers, whose creed is grounded on ancient Germanic customs, is that they are the missionaries and proteges of those forces which do not wish to see a national revival taking place in Germany. All their activities tend to turn the attention of the people away from the necessity of fighting together in a common cause against the common enemy, namely the Jew. Moreover, that kind of preaching induces the people to use up their energies not in fighting for the common cause, but in absurd and ruinous religious controversies within their own ranks. There are definite grounds that make it absolutely necessary for the movement to be dominated by a strong central force, which is embodied in the authoritative leadership. In this way alone it is possible to counteract the activity of such fatal elements. And that is just the reason why these folklore Ahasueruses are vigorously hostile to any movement whose members are firmly united under one leader and one discipline. Those people of whom I have spoken hate such a movement because it is capable of putting a stop to their mischief. It was not without good reason that when we laid down a clearly defined program for the new movement, we excluded the word völkisch from it. The concept underlying the term völkisch cannot serve as the basis of a movement because it is too indefinite and general in its application. Therefore, if somebody called himself völkisch, such a designation could not be taken as the hallmark of some definite party affiliation. Because the concept is so indefinite from the practical viewpoint, it gives rise to various interpretations, and thus people can appeal to it all the more easily as a sort of personal recommendation. Whenever such a vague concept, which is subject to so many interpretations, is admitted into a political movement, it tends to break up the disciplined solidarity of the fighting forces. No such solidarity can be maintained if each individual member be allowed to define for himself what he believes and what he is willing to do. One feels it a disgrace when one notices the kind of people who float about nowadays with the Völkisch symbol stuck in their buttonholes. And at the same time, to notice how many people have various ideas of their own as to the significance of that symbol. A well-known professor in Bavaria, a famous combatant who fights only with the weapons of the mind, and who boasts of having marched against Berlin, by shouldering the weapons of the mind, of course, believes that the word Völkisch is synonymous with monarchical. But this learned authority has hitherto neglected to explain how our German monarchs of the past can be identified with what we generally mean by the term Völkisch today. I'm afraid he will find himself at a loss if he is asked to give a precise answer. For it would be very difficult indeed to imagine anything less Völkisch than most of those German monarchical states were. Had they been otherwise, they would not have disappeared. Or if they were Völkisch, then the fact of their downfall may be taken as evidence that the Völkisch outlook on the world, Weltanschauung, is a false outlook. Everybody interprets this concept in his own way, but such multifarious opinions cannot be adopted as the basis of a militant political movement. I need not call attention to the absolute lack of worldly wisdom, and especially the failure to understand the soul of the nation, which is displayed by these messianic precursors of the 20th century. Sufficient attention has been called to those people by the ridicule which the left-wing parties have bestowed on them. They allow them to babble on and sneer at them. I do not set much value on the friendship of people who do not succeed in getting disliked by their enemies. Therefore, we considered the friendship of such people as not only worthless, but even dangerous to our young movement. That was the principal reason why we first called ourselves a party. We hoped that by giving ourselves such a name, we might scare away a whole host of Völkisch dreamers. And that was the reason also why we named our party the National Socialist German Labour Party. The first term, party, kept away all those dreamers who live in the past, and all the lovers of bombastic nomenclature, as well as those who went around beating the big drum for the Völkisch idea. The full name of the party kept away all those heroes whose weapon is the sword of the spirit, and all those whining poltroons who take refuge behind their so-called intelligence, as if it were a kind of shield. It was only to be expected that this latter class would launch a massed attack against us after our movement had started. But, of course, it was only a pen-and-ink attack, for the goose quill is the only weapon which these Völkisch lancers wield. We had declared one of our principles thus: we shall meet violence with violence in our own defence. Naturally, that principle disturbed the equanimity of the Knights of the Pen. They reproached us bitterly, not only for what they called our crude worship of the cudgel, but also because, according to them, we had no intellectual forces on our side. These charlatans did not think for a moment that a Demosthenes could be reduced to silence at a mass meeting by 50 idiots who had come there to shout him down and use their fists against his supporters. The innate cowardice of the pen-and-ink charlatan prevents him from exposing himself to such a danger, for he always works in safe retirement, and never dares to make a noise or come forward in public. Even today, I must warn the members of our young movement in the strongest possible terms to guard against the danger of falling into the snare of those who call themselves silent workers. These silent workers are not only a white-livered lot, but are also, and always will be, ignorant do-nothings. A man who is aware of certain happenings, and knows that a certain danger threatens, and at the same time sees a certain remedy which can be employed against it, is in duty bound not to work in silence, but to come out into the open and publicly fight for the destruction of the evil and the acceptance of his own remedy. If he does not do so, then he is neglecting his duty, and shows that he is weak in character, and that he fails to act either because of his timidity, or indolence, or incompetence. Most of these silent workers generally pretend to know God knows what. Not one of them is capable of any real achievement, but they keep on trying to fool the world with their antics. Though quite indolent, they try to create the impression that their silent work keeps them very busy. To put it briefly, they are sheer swindlers, political jobbers, who feel chagrined by the honest work which others are doing. When you find one of these folkish moths buzzing over the value of his silent work, you may be sure that you are dealing with a fellow who does no productive work at all, but steals from others the fruits of their honest labour. In addition to all this, one ought to note the arrogance and conceited impudence with which these obscurantist idlers try to tear to pieces the work of other people, criticizing it with an air of superiority, and thus playing into the hands of the mortal enemy of our people. Even the simplest follower, who has the courage to stand on the table in some beer hall where his enemies are gathered, and manfully and openly defend his position against them, achieves a thousand times more than these stinking hypocrites. He at least will convert one or two people to believe in the movement. One can examine his work and test its effectiveness by its actual results. But those knavish swindlers who praise their own silent work and shelter themselves under the cloak of anonymity are just worthless drones in the truest sense of the term, and are utterly useless for the purpose of our national reconstruction. In the beginning of 1920, I put forward the idea of holding our first mass meeting. On this proposal, there were differences of opinion amongst us. Some leading members of our party thought that the time was not ripe for such a meeting, and that the result might be detrimental. The press of the left had begun to take notice of us, and we were lucky enough in being able gradually to arouse their wrath. We had begun to appear at other meetings, and to ask questions or contradict the speakers, with the natural result that we were shouted down forthwith. But still we thereby gained some of our ends. People began to know of our existence, and the better they understood us, the stronger became their aversion and their enmity. Therefore we might expect that a large contingent from our friends from the Red Camp would attend our first mass meeting. I fully realized that our meeting would probably be broken up, but we had to face the fight, if not now, then some months later. Since the first day of our foundation, We were resolved to secure the future of the movement by fighting our way forward in a spirit of blind faith and ruthless determination. I was well acquainted with the mentality of those who belonged to the Red Camp, and I knew quite well that if we opposed them tooth and nail, not only would we make an impression on them, but that we might even win new followers for ourselves. Therefore, I felt that we must decide on a policy of active opposition. Herr Harrer was then the chairman of our party. He did not see eye to eye with me as to the opportune time for our first mass meeting. Accordingly, he felt himself obliged to resign from the leadership of the movement as an upright and honest man. Herr Anton Drexler took his place. I kept the work of organizing the propaganda in my own hands, and I listened to no compromise in carrying it out. We decided, on February the 24th, 1920, as the date for our first great popular meeting to be held under the aegis of this movement, which was hitherto unknown. I made all the preparatory arrangements personally. They did not take very long. The whole apparatus of our organization was set in motion for the purpose of being able to secure a rapid decision as to our policy. Within 24 hours we had to decide on the attitude we should take in regard to the questions of the day which would be put forward at the mass meeting. The notices which advertised the meeting had to bring these points before the public. In this direction, we were forced to depend on the use of posters and leaflets, the contents of which and the manner in which they were displayed were decided upon in accordance with the principles which I have already laid down in dealing with propaganda in general. They were produced in a form which would appeal to the crowd. They concentrated on a few points which were repeated again and again. The text was concise and definite, an absolutely dogmatic form of expression being used. We distributed these posters and leaflets with a dogged energy, and then we patiently waited for the effect they would produce. For our principal colour, we chose red, as it has an exciting effect on the eye, and was therefore calculated to arouse the attention of our opponents and irritate them. Thus they would have to take notice of us, whether they liked it or not, and would not forget us. One result of our tactics was to show up clearly the close political fraternization that existed also here in Bavaria, between the Marxists and the Centre Party. The political party that held power in Bavaria, which was the Bavarian People's Party, affiliated with the Centre Party, did its best to counteract the effect which our placards were having on the red masses. Thus they made a definite step to fetter our activities. If the police could find no other grounds for prohibiting our placards, then they might claim that we were disturbing the traffic in the streets. And thus the so-called German National People's Party calmed the anxieties of their red allies by completely prohibiting those placards which proclaimed a message that was bringing back to the bosom of their own people hundreds of thousands of workers who had been misled by international agitators and incensed against their own nation. These placards bear witness to the bitterness of the struggle in which this young movement was then engaged. Future generations will find in these placards a documentary proof of our determination and the justice of our own cause. And these placards will also prove how the so-called national officials took arbitrary action to strangle a movement that did not please them, because it was nationalizing the broad masses of the people and winning them back to their own racial stock. These placards will also help to refute the theory that there was then a national government in Bavaria, and they will afford documentary confirmation of the fact that if Bavaria remained nationally minded during the years 1919, 1920, 21, 22, and 23, this was not due to a national government, but it was because the national spirit gradually gained a deeper hold on the people, and the government was forced to follow public feeling. The government authorities themselves did everything in their power to hamper this process of recovery and make it impossible. But in this connection, two officials must be mentioned as outstanding exceptions. Ernst Perner was chief of police at the time. He had a loyal counsellor, Dr. Frick, who was his chief executive official. These were the only men among the higher officials who had the courage to place the interests of their country before their own interests in holding on to their jobs. Of those in responsible positions, Ernst Perner was the only one who did not pay court to the mob, but felt that his duty was towards the nation as such, and was ready to risk and sacrifice everything, even his personal livelihood, to help in the restoration of the German people, whom he dearly loved. For that reason, he was a bitter thorn in the side of the venal group of government officials. It was not the interests of the nation or the necessity of a national revival that inspired or directed their conduct. They simply truckled to the wishes of the government so as to secure their daily bread for themselves. But they had no thought whatsoever for the national welfare that had been entrusted to their care. Above all, Perner was one of those people who, in contradistinction to the majority of our so-called defenders of the authority of the state, did not fear to incur the enmity of the traitors to the country and the nation, but rather courted it as a mark of honour and honesty. For such men, the hatred of the Jews and Marxists, and the lies and calumnies they spread, were their only source of happiness in the midst of the national misery. Perner was a man of granite loyalty. He was like one of the ascetic characters of the classical era, and was at the same time that kind of straightforward German to whom the saying, "better dead than a slave," is not an empty phrase, but a veritable heart's cry. In my opinion, he and his collaborator, Dr. Frick, are the only men holding positions then in Bavaria who have the right to be considered as having taken an active part in the creation of a national Bavaria. Before holding our first great mass meeting, it was necessary not only to have our propaganda material ready, but also to have the main items of our program printed. In the second volume of this book, I shall give a detailed account of the guiding principles which we then followed in drawing up our program. Here, I will only say that the program was arranged not merely to set forth the form and content of the young movement, but also with an eye to making it understood among the broad masses. The so-called intellectual circles made jokes and sneered at it, and then tried to criticize it. But the effect of our program proved that the ideas which we then held were right. During those years, I saw dozens of new movements arise and disappear without leaving a trace behind.